Next up on This Week in Law, Professors James Miller and Stan Liebowitz join Evan Brown and me, and we tell the world that it had better let us buy our 3D printed drones with bitcoins, or we'll unleash Quentin Tarantino's war bots on them. Next up on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 244, recorded January 31st, 2014. Deep Blue versus the Universe. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We have an amazing panel. We hope you're in an economic mood because we have two economists on the show today to help us understand the latest issues at the intersection of technology and law and policy. Joining us from Smith College in Massachusetts is James Miller. Hello, James.
Hello, and thanks for having me on your show.
Great to have you. James is also an author and has written a book called Singularity Rising. You've also written on microeconomics and on game theory, really interesting topics too. So I don't think we'll get to all of that, but we'll definitely try and pick your brain on some of the really interesting stuff around the singularity. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure.
Also joining us from the University of Texas at Dallas is Stan Liebowitz. He's a professor there and also the director of the Center for Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation. Hello, Stan.
Hi, nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Also joining us is Evan Brown from the InfoLaw Group in Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Hope your Friday's going well. It's great to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
I know, me too. How great is it, Evan? Because I know you're so interested, and we constantly come back to issues around the singularity that we have an actual author on the topic with us today. So why don't we start there? Because I think if we do, it will help frame the discussion for a lot of other things that are coming up in our rundown as current in the news this week. So, James, I haven't read your book yet. It's called Singularity Rising. It was authored in fall of 2012. Is that right?
Or
published
yes,
then.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I have read a current review of it, and I am suggesting, I hope you'll appreciate this, that I'm a part of a book club that meets every month, and I put this, you know, they're calling for new books to read. So I put this on our list of maybe we'll read the book at book club. And if we do, we'd love to get authors on to help us understand things that may have left questions open. So maybe we can get you in on Skype for that too.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
But it's just a fascinating topic, and of course, for anyone who's not familiar with it, why don't we have you introduce the concept of the singularity? And I know, you know, there's just too much to try and lay it all out in a nutshell, but to the extent you can, give us an overview of your book.
Sure. Well, our entire modern civilization, the reason we've done so much more than apes is because we're a lot smarter than them. The idea of the singularity is that we're currently developing technologies that are going to create things as above us as intelligence as we are from apes. And I think there are multiple possible ways we could achieve a singularity. One of the most likely is that someone is going to be able to create a computer program that's, to say, as smart as a person. Once we've done this, because of Moore's Law, once you have a computer program that's as smart as a person, in a few years, it'll be able to think maybe twice as fast. And eventually, it'll be able to think thousands of times as fast. Then this smarter machine will be able to examine its own software to figure out ways of becoming even more intelligent. Another possible path to superhuman intelligence is where we deliberately put things in our brain. We might figure out how to make brain implants that increase human intelligence. Or we could genetically engineer super intelligence into the next generation. Right now, there's some serious research projects trying to find the genetic basis of intelligence. The Chinese, for example, have looked at the DNA of lots of kids who are really, really smart. Once we've identified the genes that create genius, we could use existing fertility technologies to create kids who are much smarter than today. And there's a possibility that within 10 years, babies will be born that are much smarter than even Einstein was. And I define the singularity as a threshold in time in which vastly increased intelligence radically remakes civilization. And I think we're almost certainly headed for a singularity if we don't destroy ourselves first.
Yeah, that's a great big if, I suppose. And we'll get to one of the reasons why that is in just a moment here. But people might be wondering, okay, so this is sort of a futurist topic, and why are we talking about the singularity on a show that deals with current issues at the intersection of technology and law? And the answer to that question is because I think, you know, we sort of slouch toward the singularity day by day and innovation by innovation. So even though we're not there yet, as you look around yourself today, James, what do you see as the strongest signs that we will be there eventually?
Well, one is Google just bought a company called, I think, DeepMind, that was working on artificial intelligence in video games. And Google paid, I think, something like $400 million for it. And the company employed some of the top artificial intelligence researchers. So this is a huge signal, not only that Google is interested in this, but that if you're a really talented computer programmer and you want to make a lot of money, going into the field of artificial intelligence is a great way to do it. I mean, Google is probably not planning for a singularity. They're planning for the next 10 years, and they think that AI is going to be spectacularly profitable. And, you know, the better AI gets, you know, eventually we'll have computers smart enough to give us a singularity.
Right. Are we even going to know when that happens? I mean, it seems like devices become more and more intelligent and helpful. At least they're attempting to be helpful each and every day. Are we really even going to know when something, you know, are we going to be able to identify the singularity when it happens?
Probably, because I think there's a good chance we're going to experience something called an intelligence explosion. It's really easy to make changes in software. So once computers are smart enough, they'll be able to look at their own software and I think very quickly increase their own intelligence. So we might go from, you know, one day computers are about as smart as a typical human, and maybe literally 24 hours later, they've achieved super intelligence. And so I think there could be a very sharp break. Now, if we realize it or not, unfortunately, there's a decent chance that these super intelligences will decide to kill us immediately. So we might just die. The whole civilization might just end. And I think that's likely to happen because we know from physics there's a limited amount of free energy in the universe. And so a super intelligence that, say, just wanted to be really good at chess would realize, hey, you know, the molecules in people, I would rather use them in, you know, making chess hardware. So I think I'll kill everyone just to make a bunch of chess computers.
Well, that's a fun thought as I send my kid off to chess class every week. I'll just have to bear that in mind, that we could be heading toward the dystopian future where an AI just uses us all to make chess a better game. Evan, this is really your pet topic even more than mine. Do you have any questions for James before we move away from the broader topic of the singularity and the legal and ethical issues that it raises and into some related stories?
Gosh, I mean, it's really hard to isolate it into one issue, but you know, a motif that comes up a lot on the show, and I think that's where we can fruitfully expand out and have a conversation about this, is the way that the advance of technology will affect us at the social layer. And, you know, James, that was a huge, a very colorful example of really the dark side of it. Chess, you know, computer programmed to be an excellent chess player, destroying the universe, conceivably. you know, so I guess, you know, the general, less than it being a question, would just be kind of a general statement, general notion, trying to lay a platform for where we can jump off and discuss these things in more detail, is how these advances in technology where, you know, if you want to characterize it as post-singularity or transhumanism, or if you want to even kind of adopt kind of the 19th century, early 20th century concept of eugenics. I mean, that seems so unpolitically correct, but you know, there's some ways of seeing how this could be the modern incarnation of that notion here. You know, how is it going to affect us? And this is, I'm not looking for an answer here, but just kind of laying the platform, like I say. I mean, how is this going to affect us really at the social layer so that we can have a discussion about laws and the way norms should fit into all of this in a bunch of different areas? It just seems like it's going to be inescapable that these advances in technologies, if they actually do start affecting us in very intimate ways, machines going into our bodies, becoming part of our bodies, where it becomes indistinguishable what a machine and what a human is, or where we are affected externally from all of these things. You know, we just have these precursors of it now, Google Glass being kind of a good example of the augmented reality leading into some sort of transhumanism. So, yeah, I mean, I just want to have a conversation, break that, all those topics out as to how these, you know, this new status post-singularity will, how we should make laws and regulate ourselves to exist and thrive in that environment.
Yeah, I mean, one big issue is going to be unemployment and welfare laws. As we, I think, approach a singularity, we're going to get machines that can do more and more of what people do. And we might have vast segments of our population that just can't be productively put to work, or people who, you know, who won't be able to earn more than $5 an hour in a free market. So we're going to have to decide what to do with them. And I don't know a good answer to that. I think we might end up with a society where, you know, people basically play video games and do art and have fun and are supported by the small number of people who have jobs and by capital holders. It's going to be a very difficult issue to deal with.
Well, I've seen this idea of where that could happen. And then there's also this amelioration of suffering that could occur, particularly in the third world. And I think, did you describe it as somehow eliminating the cognitive, I don't remember precisely how you articulated, but eliminating the cognitive, what was that whole point?
Yeah, cognitive gap. I mean, people in third world countries really have horrible educational systems. I mean, even when, you know, you build a school in India, that doesn't mean that the teacher will show up or that the teacher knows what she's talking about. And I think that, you know, cheap computers might hold the potential of radically increasing education opportunities in third world countries. You know, you can see someone like Bill Gates coming up with, you know, a $5, educational computer and just dropping them all over Africa. And that could significantly, you know, if given to children, that might be able to significantly raise IQs in Africa, which could do a lot for their economic development.
How do we reconcile? I mean, those seem to be two ends of one spectrum or two sides of a coin, opposite notions of where we could be eliminating, reducing suffering because of this. And I'm overgeneralizing perhaps, but this whole notion of what you were talking about, better education with in the first world, where we would see everybody being reduced to being couch potatoes with nothing better to do than to watch Jerry Springer all day. Are those two concepts in tension with one another, or can they be reconciled, or are they apples and oranges?
Intelligence is a tool, and you know, a tool can be used, can have positive or negative effects. But I mean, even in the first world, you can, you know, people who are couch potatoes, we could design it so almost everyone is better off. I mean, most people don't like their jobs, and most people, I think, would be quite happy if they could sort of have a dignified unemployment. And, you know, if society didn't, you know, really need their efforts. So there aren't necessarily in tension. I mean, you know, it's losing your job wouldn't be a bad thing if you could maintain the same or get a higher standard of living.
But what about the backlash? The bullet point under your book and describing it on Amazon, one of them is, let's see if I can find the proper one. Competition with billions of cheap AIs drives human wages to almost nothing, you mentioned a minute ago, while making investors rich. What about the resentment factor there? And I mean, it seems like we're talking about making class differences even more pronounced and really getting to less utopia and more dystopia, or no?
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends how you look at it. I think... Mm-hmm. We could make everyone richer, but the people who own a lot of capital will gain proportionately more. Maybe their income goes up by a factor of 100, while the average American is three times richer. So it kind of depends on, do you think inequality is bad per se, Or would you, do you think it would be a better world if everyone got richer, but the rich got richer proportionally than the poor did? And, you know, I mean, my personal view is I'm not concerned at all about inequality. I think it's important to care a lot about the people who are the poorest, but that's different from worrying about the, you know, the difference, the percent difference in wealth between the richest and the poorest.
Stan, do you want to offer any thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, I actually think this is sort of getting into the realm of science fiction. And I actually think some of the science fiction writers had talked about this, even though I can't give you at the moment because I haven't looked at that literature in a long time. But it's not going to be, it's going to be a process that's going to go and take, I think, a long time. In economics, we have a basic assumption, which is that we have scarcity. And it's the scarcity that causes the problems of figuring out what to produce and then how to allocate what we produced. And that's what's underlying all the assumptions in the discussion I'm hearing is, well, some people are going to have a lot more than others. If there's going to be an end result here where we have these machines, let's say, that are just so smart and so capable, they may be able to produce so much of everything that we think we want that scarcity disappears. If scarcity disappears, then everybody has as much of everything as they want, and you don't worry about the 1% versus the 99% because nobody needs any more material goods than they already have. Now, it's hard to imagine what a world would be like where there was no scarcity. And it would probably turn out that there were still things that people wanted which were scarce, like power. And that's where things would, the competition between people would take place. But in this world that you're envisioning, if it's machines that become so smart, then there may be no scarcity and human beings can have everything that they want materially, but there's really no point in our existence, except that maybe the machines like having us around the way we like having lots of wildlife around that we don't consume, that don't necessarily have any economic purpose anymore. It's a very interesting issue one can talk about, because what would be interesting is partly between that endpoint of having as much of everything as we want and where we are now, there's this question of what happens while you're getting there, as presumably more and more people have their jobs replaced by machines, and people are not particularly good. We talk about comparative advantage as well, where everyone's better at something relatively than others. And so there's always something for you to do, even if you're not particularly good at anything. If we have these machines that are better than us at everything, it's not clear that there'd be this comparative advantage for us anymore. And we might run into this situation where the owners of the machines, or the capital that's being used to make the machines, do get a disproportionately large share of what's produced in the future. We have redistribution in our country and most of the other leading countries, there'd be a lot of political tension to keep that redistribution up and maybe increase it. And politics winds up becoming an important role. And of course, we could get so concerned about the redistribution that we wind up destroying everything. The Luddites, if I remember correctly, were against, they wanted to destroy the machines that were being used to help advance the well-being of people. And you could have Luddites who just decide we have to destroy all the machines. That could well happen in, you know, one branch of an imagined world here. So there's a lot of interesting topics. But I don't think any of us are going to see what you're calling the singularity. And you're using the term the way I see fundamentalists using the term rapture, as if it's like some tiniest moment where something is going to be different. It's going to be a long process, and it's not going to be black and white where one day you're not there and the next day you are. There are a lot of interesting topics, but none of us are going to see what you're calling the singularity in our lifetime. I'm pretty sure about that.
I don't agree. I mean, why do you think artificial intelligence is so difficult? I mean, would you agree if we could put a human brain on a computer chip? You know, today there was someone at Google said, well, we have a computer that's just as smart as a person. And because of Moore's Law,
the computer that's just as smart as a person.
You don't think that we're going to get that in our lifetime?
Our lifetime.
Well, David, I mean, why not? Can we stop and put some definitions around this too? I mean, because I'm no neuroscientist, I'm no computer scientist, so I'm probably the least qualified person, you know, in the Western Hemisphere to talk about this. But, you know, from reading Kurzweil and others, it seems to me that the way that we quantify human intelligence is different in kind than the way that we can quantify machine intelligence based on current computer science and processing power, the, you know, parallel processing versus serial processing and a bunch of different factors in there. So, I mean, it seems like we shouldn't gloss over the idea of what it means to quantify intelligence so that we can say that a machine is as smart as a human or vice versa. Is there anything to be said definitionally before we start arguing and debating that point?
Well, sure. I mean, if a computer can do anything that a person can do, you know, I mean, a computer right now that can play chess better than people. They can do statistical studies better than people.
What about enjoy a sunset?
You can't define that. So that's one of those ways, you know, that I don't think that has any meaning. How could you falsify? If I were to say a computer can enjoy a sunset more than a person and you were to say no, what observations could we make that would determine who was right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's a phenomenological problem, but I still know that I enjoy sunsets. But anyway, let's go on.
Right. The point that raises then is, you know, is it appropriate to put no meaning on enjoyment of sunsets? You know, is there a way to think about this where you have to factor in that there are things that are not quantifiable?
I don't think you need to. I mean, ultimately it might just come down to military ability. If computers can create weapons that can defeat any weapons, you know, that humans can create, they'll be able to take over the planet if they want.
You know, I didn't want to disrupt where the two of you were having that conversation because, you know, that I interjected that we should define some terms here. So if there's any way we could just go back to that point, because that was really good and I should have just popped some popcorn and sat back and listened.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, computers clearly have gotten much better at doing specific tasks. I don't know any computers that can do statistical analyses. They can run regressions that we tell them to run, but they don't know what regressions they need to run. And so I don't see anything remotely close yet. And I don't think there's been a big push to produce a computer that's capable of performing an analysis in a particular subject that's sort of a more scientific subject. When I start seeing them capable of doing that, then we're maybe getting closer to having, you know, more of the science fiction version of machines that can really sort of think. What we have now are machines that can do particular tasks extremely well.
Let me give you an example. Let's say that Amazon writes a computer program, and this computer program does statistical analysis to determine the optimal price or the optimal type of advertisement to send to a customer. And this program runs without any human input after it was written, and it does a better job of figuring out what customers want than what a person could do. Would you say then we've taken a big step towards a singularity if Amazon creates that?
No.
And are you predicting Amazon will not be able to create that in your lifetime?
Not until the computer can write the program. I mean, the person is writing the program, and then the computer is looking at the data and deciding what the pricing should be. But it's deciding it based on the algorithms that are being put into the program. When you show me the computers that's writing the algorithms, okay, then that's a different story.
I mean, I doubt there's any economist who could write a computer program to do statistical analysis if you start with machine learning.
Well, no one can write... people are writing programs to do stuff like that, but
they're using
doing
computers to write the computer programs. I mean, they're using the compiler and the computer software. They're using programs that were, you know, people worked on a long, long time ago.
Translating, they're not writing programs.
But people don't do that either. There's no human being that can do that. That could start with,
right,
you know,
there
the
are
zeros.
Things computers can do that people can't. But the things that people can do that computers can't are what we're talking about.
Can you give me an example?
It happens.
What's something that you could say this task where there would be an observation that would determine that you were possibly wrong?
Where I say to the computer, go and tell me, perform a statistical analysis. You figure out what techniques to use, to tell me something that, you know, here's something that I've worked on. Tell me whether or not file sharing decreases record sales.
Okay, so if I could, if there's a way I could speak into Google and says, does file sharing decrease records sales? And it was able to come up with an answer. You would say that's, you don't think that could happen within our lifetime, or you could ask a question of that level.
Oh, it might happen within our lifetime, but that's still not quite what you're talking about, what we're talking about. We're, they're better than we are. But when I see that, I'll believe we're getting a lot closer. That doesn't exist yet.
We are pretty close. I mean, I think a computer could, if it understands natural language, it would do a Google search and it would try to find papers. It wouldn't do the original research.
But people have done. It wouldn't be creating anything.
It would be solving it in the most effective way. I mean, it would be.
If someone had done that before, it's not clear that it would know how to do it. Yet people figured out how to do it without having to go and see what somebody had done before who had done the same thing.
But, I mean, most people who do that, you know, they use programs that other people have written. Right? Most people don't start from scratch.
The statistical package they use has been written by somebody else. That's right. Most economists use data. I know the people that created it because they were at UCLA when I was a graduate student there. Mm-hmm. They spend a lot of time working on new components of Stata that allow people to do new techniques that weren't there before statistically. All right. But that's the package people use. By itself, Stata can't do anything. It needs someone to tell it what to do. And then it's just a tool. It runs numbers and pops an answer out. It's just running a statistical algorithm.
I mean, intelligence is an optimization force. You're trying to figure out how to solve a problem. And an intelligent agent would use anything available. If there were already packages, statistical packages out there, it would use it.
Right. I guess as I listen to this, okay. I think that the way that humans create is not that different than the way an artificial intelligence would create. You know, you would go out and you would find whatever resources and information that you can, and then you would attempt to draw conclusions and attempt to find some solutions that hadn't been tried before. And I don't see why. I guess I come down on James's side on this, why an artificial intelligence conceivably couldn't do that.
I don't think it's not. I think it can do mm-hmm. it. Okay. I just don't think it's going to do it anytime soon. Uh-huh. By soon, I mean within our lifetime.
Even taking into account the exponential rate at which technologies advance. I know that I fall into that trap all the time, thinking that, you know, we will advance in the next 10 years at the same rate we've advanced in the last 10 years, where, you know, I mean, it just seems like there's that old, I mean, what is it? It goes all the way back to 1001 Arabian Nights, right? With the idea of one rice grain doubled every or whatever, you know, there are lots of vivid illustrations of exponential growth. So, you know, I guess I'm just throwing that out there.
Whether it will remain exponential, there have been questions about whether Moore's law is going to continue to go. They're having problems, which I presume they'll overcome in continuing to get to smaller and smaller, you know, densities of putting transistors on chips. But mm-hmm. They have been running into some trouble, and they've gone to 3D to try to get around that. And I presume they will, and Intel seems to have had some success. But whether it will continue to grow exponentially or not is not something we know with certainty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There has been, for a long time, something called diminishing returns. And if diminishing returns were to set in here, then it will take a lot longer to get where you think you're going to go than you're currently thinking. You're assuming that you're going to continue to have increasing returns or exponential growth. Maybe, maybe not.
Mm-hmm. What would be some examples of those diminishing returns? I mean, because are you talking totally from a technical standpoint, or could we be talking external, you know, us realizing at a cultural, societal level that this advancement is not what we want because of all the negative side effects, the dark underbelly of the uses of these technologies, going back to chess computers destroying the planet?
Well, generally, diminishing returns are thought to be not something that is brought about by society, even though I guess one can construct a theory in which that plays a role. But it's just that as you apply more and more of some resource into production, that resource winds up having less and less of a powerful positive effect. All right. So let's say that it turns out it starts becoming increasingly difficult to increase the capacity to put transistors on chips with greater density. Okay, hypothetically, if that were to happen, then you start running into basically this problem where you're putting more and more effort into creating the chips and getting less and less out of each new attempt to increase the productivity of the chip. If that were to take place, then that's going to slow everything down in your scenario. And the use of resources to try to make the chips denser would be where the diminishing returns is coming in. Whatever resources that you're using to increase the density is having a diminishing impact on actually increasing the density.
Gotcha.
That would be an example of how diminishing returns work. We have what we call a law of diminishing returns because when you take a look at typical production of products. So let me give you a very simple example we use in the classroom. Okay, farmers want to grow a crop on the land. Okay, if you talk about increasing one input at a time, so you have a farm of a certain size, it's 1 acre, say, all right, and you start increasing the amount of fertilizer, you'll get more crops being grown, holding the watering and holding the size of the plot constant. But as you put more and more fertilizer on, eventually you stop getting increased plants. And eventually, if you put enough fertilizer on, you'll crush everything. Mm-hmm. And you won't get any plants. And that's sort of like, for a particular input, how you wind up having to have the case that you must achieve the point of diminishing marginal productivity. That's why it was a law, though. We tend to think that that tends to occur everywhere. All right. Now, admittedly, that is for physical production of most products. And, you know, we also assume that you can't have increasing returns, but whether you can find a production of something where increasing returns goes forever is, it's questionable. I don't know that that's something we can point to in the past. And even if you find some process where that's always occurred for the last 100 years since the process has been around, it doesn't mean it will necessarily continue. So we've had a pretty good run with computer chips, and that run may continue, and it may continue to grow exponentially. But that would make it quite different than most other processes of other things that have been built in the past.
All right. Fascinating context for our discussion of the singularity. I think we'll make singularity our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're a lawyer and you would like to apply for continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction, we have some information about that over at the TWIT Wiki at wiki.twit.tv. And it may be that you're in another profession where this applies too. So we put these phrases in the show in case you have to verify for some oversight body that you actually watched or listened. So that's our little present to you. Let's move the discussion.
Can I say one little thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Even if you have decreasing returns, it doesn't mean you won't get to the point where the machines are so smart that they can do this. It merely affects the speed with which you'll get there. That's all.
Right. And that seems to be the only thing that you two are maybe not precisely on the same page about with respect to the singularity is just the question of when.
Right.
Seem right? Yeah. Yes. Okay, so let's look at something that's going on present day that is sort of a real world experiment in how artificial intelligence might play into economies now and going forward. And that is Bitcoin. We keep coming back to Bitcoin on the show. I appreciate everyone who got in touch with me after last week's show when I posed a question about Bitcoin mining and exactly how that works. And I've come between the show, having chatted with people and read some stuff, I've come to the conclusion that it is less pyramid scheme, although there is that component, and more SETI at home as far as the mining process goes. But that's sort of beside the point that I want to get to. And that is this whole notion of software and algorithms and the economy and currency. Because there's certainly no reason why Obviously Bitcoin has taken off and we're not sure what's going to happen with it, but with its current valuation, it's certainly made people stand up and take notice, and it's certainly having an economic impact. And so against the backdrop of our singularity discussion, I wanted to pick both our guests' brains on what they think cryptocurrencies mean and what is likely to happen in the future. James, we'll start with you.
Sure. I think the people who would get the most benefit out of things like Bitcoins are criminals and corrupt government officials. They're the ones who really need a way of transferring cash without there being a way of relating the cash back to them. So I think it's very likely. I think Bitcoin either won't become popular or it will be banned by the U.S. government. And one thing our government's very good at doing is cracking down on banking systems that it doesn't like. So I don't really see a very bright future for Bitcoin. And I don't think it's something that most people should be investing in either.
Although okay,
the technology behind it is wonderful.
Yeah, this is actually fairly interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with the game Hot Potato or not, but that's where kids throw a something that you could rethink of as a hot potato, but some sort of object like a ball or something back and forth until a bell rings and then who's ever left with it loses. That's what you're going to see happen, I suspect, with Bitcoin. There was a history of private currencies. It's not like we've had a world where we've only had government currencies. In the 1800s, the U.S. had private currencies. But the private currencies were created basically by institutions like big banks. And the federal government, did basically bring all of that to an end. And James is right. I think the federal government will do it again. The difference between Bitcoin and the private currencies of the 1800s is when a big bank was saying, we have our own pieces of paper here where we promise to either convert it into U.S. dollars or gold at some exchange rate. Why should you take our paper, which cost us virtually nothing to print, and give us goods for it, which is what the person who's creating the currency gets? It's called seigniorage, after Mr. Senior from a long time ago. It's great to be able to print the money because you get goods for it. You buy something. That's how people get the money generally. That people were willing to take that paper because those banks were big institutions that had a lot of money, not as much as the U.S. government. They weren't as powerful as the U.S. government, but they were big, powerful institutions that people felt would not cheat and take their money away and disappear overnight. Bitcoin doesn't have that. There's no reason whatsoever in the world to think that it won't be gone tomorrow. And anyone who has taken good money and bought Bitcoin with it will find themselves with the hot potato, where they lose and they wind up with nothing. What's going on now, as far as I can see, is it's almost a little bit of a bubble. Everyone who's familiar with bubbles knows that prices can't go up forever on things, and that they'll return to their real value eventually. And the real value of Bitcoin may be zero because there's no one behind it with any assets to make good against the claims that you have with the Bitcoin currency. So what you're going to wind up with is people are seeing that it's gone up in value. And there's chances if you get in now, you can find a bigger fool who's going to pay even a higher price than you paid. I mean, when we had the housing bubble, which was a small bubble, everyone was buying and selling houses. Lots of people were. And it wasn't like they rationally thought that the price of houses would go up forever at the rate they were going. But as long as you can get out without getting stuck, it's a good deal. And everyone thinks they can get out in time, and they don't realize they're going to be the ones left with the hot potato. So all the foreclosed houses and the housing bubbles were like the hot potatoes to some extent. And a lot of them were being sold by speculators, and the speculators, a lot of them got burned. They made tons of money in advance. And I think that's what's going on with Bitcoin. It's very trendy. People like to get involved with and get their name out there. It gives them a little bit of publicity for a seller of items, a department store, to say that they're now taking Bitcoin. But when enough people do it, you don't get any publicity for it. And I just don't think there's anything inherent in the Bitcoin phenomenon of why there should be value. When, a big company If Google wants to say we have a currency, or Microsoft has a currency, or Goldman Sachs, or somebody who you think has the financial wherewithal to be able to stand up, and I'm not sure Goldman Sachs is the best choice after what happened in 2008, but a big company might do it and say we're putting our resources behind it. The U.S. government will still stop it, but until it's stopped, at least it's not completely artificial. Bitcoin, I think, is just completely artificial.
I do think Bitcoin has real value for criminal enterprises.
It was something
like the Silk Road, where if you want to be able to pay for something anonymously, there could be an equilibrium in which people sort of agree to use Bitcoins. And so I think Bitcoin could survive if the governments don't crack down on it.
We have two economists here who can help me understand this better, so I'm going to take advantage of that. Is that simply, James, because we're not dealing with pieces of paper with numbers on them that have been issued by a government? It seems to me that cash can be plenty anonymous too, and I don't understand why Bitcoin is necessarily the currency of choice if you're engaged in criminal activity.
Oh, because you could be an FBI agent, for example. Let's imagine that I do something. I say, look, I'll mail you heroin in return for you giving me money. But from my point of view, you could be an FBI agent, or you could turn informer. I don't want to meet with you because I could get arrested, and I don't want you to mail me something because then you got to know my address. But with Bitcoin, you could transfer your Bitcoins to me in a way where if the NSA hasn't secretly beaten Bitcoin's encryption, that no one will ever find out. And you can't do that with cash. You certainly can't do that with checks or credit card. So it does fulfill a function for criminals or for people trying to evade government that there's no parallel with any other type of currency.
You just got to make sure
the one problem there is it has to be convertible into real cash. So you can't just have criminals use it, because if the criminals have their own currency but they can't convert it to buy anything in the real world, it won't be worthwhile for them. They have to be able to convert their Bitcoins into actual real cash that you use elsewhere in the economy. So if it fails in the rest of the economy, it's going to fail for the criminals as well. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Evan, we stepped on your comment there.
Oh, no. There was one unserious thing and then one sort of serious thing. I mean, you just got to make sure none of your DNA gets on that package of heroin. Then they can figure out who you are.
That's true.
The other thing is, I mean, is Bitcoin kind of like tulip mania? I'm talking about, of course, the Dutch. What the Dutch did was back in the 1600s, where these transactions happen, where the asset really has no intrinsic value. I mean, come on, you could crush a tulip bulb with a hammer, but people were buying and selling land based on this thing. I mean, is there anything you learned from that episode?
I thought it was, until I read a comment, I think on the blog Marginal Revolution, about how Bitcoins are really useful for corrupt Chinese officials, and they very much want to take currency out of China, but it's difficult to do. And Bitcoin is allowing them to do this. And there's so much corrupt money in China that if it really is performing that function, it has significant value to people.
Yeah, and I wrote a blog post a couple months ago about an Australian company, Tom Carr, who was accepting Bitcoin. And this was kind of dawned on me. It's like, oh my gosh, there's uses outside of Silk Road for this. And one of the reasons that they talked about was that there were no or it avoids a lot of the transaction costs, exchange rates, processing fees, and things like that. Is that something that could be a permanent benefit, or would that eventually be done away with?
I don't think that's worth it, because the Bitcoin value fluctuates enough with the dollar that if you're primarily, you're primarily dealing with dollars, then there's a currency risk you have to take on. And I have a feeling for almost everyone that would swamp the transaction fees of having to deal with credit cards. So I don't think that can work. That
makes sense.
You also have the case. Okay, everybody could use the dollar right now, and there are other countries that use the dollar as their currency. But most of the countries don't want to use a second country's currency, and that's because there's a real value to being able to create your own currency. So, I mean, governments are going to have a serious motivation to try to keep some other currency from dominating, and so they would try to stop Bitcoin. But my guess is that they won't really have to. It'll die on its own. That is just a little fad that we have.
What about the notion that we have a couple of stories in the rundown around people attempting to build legitimate businesses in the Bitcoin economy? The state of New York is apparently considering adding a Bit license for businesses that operate primarily in Bitcoin. James, would that solve the problem, the anonymity problem, if you had to be licensed and had a degree of oversight from the state that went along with that?
Well, I don't think that would help. I mean, there would become people who would be legitimate businessmen, and they would probably end up taking money from criminals in terms of Bitcoins, but everything the businessmen would do would be above board. So in a sense, I think that would just be a way of laundering money from criminals or from corrupt government officials in other countries. Because if I'm licensed, there's no way for me to know that someone who transferred Bitcoins to me isn't a criminal.
So what do you guys think about Charlie Shrem having been arrested? He's the CEO of Bitcoin exchange BitInstant, and he's being charged with money laundering, as you say, James. And, you know, there's no real indication. I haven't gotten, you know, too deep into the allegations and indictment against him. But it certainly seems like the folks who set up BitInstant were attempting to have a legitimate business here.
It's hard because there isn't, if you have a purely legitimate business, there's not really a need to use Bitcoins unless you're sort of doing it for the novelty or advertising value.
Evan, what do you think about this guy? I think you're muted.
Am I still?
No, you're good.
Oh, okay. I mean, I feel sorry for the guy. He's 24 and he's being arrested and indicted for stuff that he did when he was 22. So to me, that there's just more of a human element story, the human foible side of this, the irresistible, despite the fact of trying to be above board and to run a legitimate enterprise here, there was just the irresistible temptation. If indeed the allegations turn out to be true, this is America, innocent until proven guilty and all that stuff. But, you know, there was this anonymity, this perceived, it was perceived to be a safe way of doing something that was a way to bring in a lot of income really quickly. So I just see it. The thing that impresses me most is the human aspect of it. How, despite one's intentions or outward statements of trying to do it right, there's this ability of Bitcoin to facilitate transactions like this that are unlawful.
Is there a copyright law parallel here with sort of a Grokster-like liability that's being imposed, that even if an exchange is not itself engaged in illegal acts, if it knows that its users are, or it's willfully blind to the fact that its users are, and now I'm munging up Grokster with the DMCA and its case law, but you know where I'm going with this. What do you think?
Right. Well, I mean, isn't Bitcoin even much more decentralized than what file sharing software was or is? I mean, Bitcoin is more like BitTorrent than it is Grokster, and certainly more than Napster. Napster was very centralized. So it would seem, you know, with Grokster liability for secondary liability for copyright infringement, that depends on what the object of the purveyor of the device was. And here it seems like with Bitcoin, the idea of who the purveyor is vapor. Who is it that you would try to pin liability? I mean, the BitTorrent protocol is different than BitTorrent as a currency. So I don't know who you would try to pin it onto. I would invite anybody to address that.
I mean, I think if you're running a Silk Road like business and it's pretty clear people are trading drugs using your website, you probably have liability for that.
Yeah. I thought the Bitcoin topic was interesting against the backdrop of our singularity discussion, just in the context of economic systems that sort of run via software and algorithm, and whether either of you thinks that that is something that we're going to see more of Stan?
Okay. What's the that in that sentence? What are we going to see more?
Economic systems that are software driven, and money that is that comes into existence through computers working with one another to break codes and put more money into the system, as Bitcoin does.
The only way I would see that this idea of like using computer mining or something would be if some government wanted to be able to prove that it wasn't going to inflate its currency, which is not an issue right now. We don't have in most major currencies inflation problems. But if there were inflation problems, I could see them saying, taking a currency they have and saying, this is, instead of having the Fed promise to limit growth, they could have them say, well, we're going to use some sort of Bitcoin-type technology to limit how many new dollars we can print. Okay, that would be a way of trying to prove that they're going to not produce too many dollars. But that seems pretty far-fetched to me as something that's likely to actually happen, because the government can always break its promise. We're going to see funds being transferred all entirely electronically. That I believe is certainly going to happen, and it'll all be digital, it'll all be over the internet. But currencies aren't going to be created through Bitcoin type mechanisms. Countries don't want that. They want, when they have their own currency, to have control over it, which is why they got rid of all the private currencies that existed in the 1800s. And like I said, there's a value to being able to create your own currencies, and countries want to have their own separate currency. So Europe is not about to take the U.S. dollar, and the dollar U.S. is not about to take the euro. They could. Okay, and it would make transactions easier because everyone would be on the same currency. But countries aren't willing to give up the value in having their own currency to do that, and so I don't see the politics of that changing much. So if I think I understand what your question was, transactions are going to be over the internet. It's going to be digital. It's not going to be Bitcoin type of stuff, though.
I think there's a way it could come about through hedge funds. One of the ways we might get a singularity is that hedge funds have an enormous amount of computing power, and they keep creating better programs that do faster and more efficient trades. And it might be that lots of different hedge funds have lots of different computers that are making trades with each other, and the computers come up with their own types of currency. It's not something available to most people, and most of us would never even hear of it. But through sort of the shadow banking system, these currencies might emerge.
Okay, let's wrap up the Bitcoin discussion with this story about the Bitcoin ATM that was installed in, was this in Canada, Evan? I don't know why I think that that's where this took place.
I don't know.
In Vancouver, yes. At a coffee shop in Vancouver, the world's first Bitcoin ATM was put into operation. Now, the way this thing works, it's made by a company called RoboCoin, and it doesn't take debit or credit cards. It's cash only. So if you have cash and you want Bitcoins, you put your money in, and you have to put in a lot of money these days to get even one Bitcoin out. You're going to get numbers that are addresses that link to Bitcoin, so you can buy them that way. Or if you already have some, the machine can scan a QR code on your mobile phone and it will dispense you cash. So it does an exchange. And so the operators of this ATM put it in, and they noticed that there were a bunch of transactions all in a row that were voided. So they went in to see what was going on. And it turns out some enterprising person set himself up with a sign next to the ATM saying, I'm going to give you a better exchange rate. So don't use this ATM, I'll do it for you. So they undermined the whole purpose of the ATM. And now they've hired someone to sit next to the ATM, someone named Cameron Gray, who's earning $12 an hour to make sure that nobody comes in and tries to offer a competitive exchange rate in immediate proximity to the ATM. And also, he's, I think, trying to encourage folks to get involved in other Bitcoin-related activities that the ATM owners are doing, something called CoinTrader. So what did you think about all this, Evan, the guy with the sign and then the reaction of, you know, the legal ramifications, I suppose, of saying, hey, you know, you can't undercut us competitively.
Right. Well, I mean, at first, conclusion I had about it was the fact that it's an ATM sort of undermines the purpose of it being a Bitcoin transaction to begin with. So it's like it's inherently self-contradictory or whatever, because it takes away. I mean, does this have a little video camera on it so they can get your identity and tie that with that particular Bitcoin transaction and then follow it through the chain and what have you? But mm-hmm. as far as this this other part of it, Cameron Gray sitting next to it and offering a competitive service, it reminded me a little bit of the law of trademarks and how there's this law that developed about competitive advertising. You know, is it all right, for example, for Walgreens to put, you know, the Walgreens brand of painkiller next to the ibuprofen, like Walbuprofen or whatever it's called, you know, in the right. same kind of coloring on the shelves. And then, of course, we see that in online advertising with ads, especially the sponsored ads listing, you type in Ford and it shows you an ad for Chevy, you know, those things like that. So looking at it from a branding and a marketing perspective, I don't think it's all that clear cut that what they were doing, whomever it was, Cameron Gray was the chaperone, right? I mean, right. Whoever it was that was holding up the sign saying, I'll give you a better exchange rate. I don't think it's clear cut, at least under U.S. law, that there would be anything wrong with that. But then, of course, there are all these other issues that come in, like, you know, right of trespass, you know, where can you be on the property and mm-hmm. all that stuff. So it's one of those interesting little scenarios that gives us a few things to talk about to go out in several different directions in identifying issues with this.
James, Evan hit on something though that I think is kind of interesting and relating to our discussion a few minutes ago. If we wind up with intermediaries like ATMs that insert themselves into the Bitcoin ecosystem, does that destroy the anonymity that encourages crime?
Well, no, it would actually encourage crime more because the criminals could then use another agent. So if I have a lot of Bitcoins I got through selling heroin, then I would, you know, transfer the Bitcoins to someone else who then would get cash for it and then give the cash to me. So it would be a way of allowing criminals to launder their money and to get dollars for their money. So
okay. Stan, any thoughts on the ATM?
No, I find the whole ATM thing slightly strange. I presume it's largely a publicity stunt. And it maybe they're also throwing in, you know, essentially very high exchange rates. And we don't normally talk about exchange rates when we're talking about ATMs because the currency is all the same. You have the fee that you have to pay to use right. the ATM. And if you charge an exorbitantly high fee, it comes out in this case as a bad exchange rate. And this guy was willing to sit next to the ATM and basically say, I'm giving you a lower transaction fee to do your exchange. If there really was, if Bitcoins actually were serious and people want it, because the whole thing with currency is people have to trust it. If people really do wind up trusting Bitcoins, I don't think they will, but if they do, then they will exchange them and there'll be ATMs out there and they'll compete with one another just as they do now. And it would exist. I don't think Bitcoins will in fact be treated that way, but if they were, then you should see that the interaction between them and people should be just like our currency now, between people and the currency. And it will be regulated. You know, I'm sure that it takes a license in most places. I'm not sure, but I suspect it would to be able to translate one currency to another. I don't know that you could, without a license from someone, but I could be wrong. So to say I'm opening up a shop to allow people to transmit currency back and forth, only because it would be so easy to launder money that way. And the government doesn't like to allow people. You have to get a license for almost everything these days. And I'm sure there must be one involved with that too.
Let me ask one more question Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I just want to say one sort of conspiracy theory. We, of course, don't know the real identity of the guy who created Bitcoins. And I think there's a chance it was created by the U.S. government and it's sort of they're running a scam. They're trying to get a bunch of criminals and terrorists to use it. And at some point, they're going to be like, hey, guess what? We know everything that was done with Bitcoins. You know, we and we're going to arrest a whole bunch of people. I mean, that's probably not true, but there's maybe 10% chance it is, I would estimate.
That's certainly possible, but it has inspired a whole bunch of copycat kind of currencies. And that leads me to my last question about cryptocurrencies before we move on to war machines and other dystopian topics. And that is, building on what you just said, Stan, that people have to trust currencies, pushing back on that a little and wondering if they really do. I mean, do you think that people are investing or buying or trading things with Kanye West coins because they trust it or because for some reason or another, it's appealing to them, it's cool to them? Fred Wilson made a point at a forum about Bitcoins that if JP Morgan Chase came up with a Bitcoin, he said no one's going to build on top of that because it doesn't have this sort of open, distributed, verifiable, you know, we're all in it together, open source aspect to it that Bitcoin has. So that there are different things about these currencies that appeal to different people that that may have something to do with trust or may not. So what do you think about that, Stan?
For a currency to be in existence for a long time and to be taken seriously by a lot of people, they do have to trust it. And I would give, you know, a big bank a much greater chance of being successful with a currency than an anonymous person we don't know who creating a currency and without anything to back it up. So I think that that's exactly wrong. There are people who like it because they like the way it's being created and it's appealing to them. And they'll buy it just for the fun of it, but that's not what people normally use currencies for. And eventually, if it's really going to last as a currency, it has to be trusted. The fact that it's going up and down in price all the time makes it very poor as a currency. Okay, it would have to really smooth out before you could seriously use it as a currency because people want to be able to have stability. You'd have to have futures markets, as we do now. We have futures market in all these currencies. So people who are using currencies to exchange with one another in different countries, you know how many dollars you'll have to give up in a year to buy something in euros after it's delivered because you can go to the futures market and you can guarantee what the exchange rate is between dollars and euros in a year by going in the futures market. You'd have to have markets like that grow, develop around Bitcoin before it became reasonable to possibly start using it as a currency for transactions. Now it's something that appeals to speculative purposes because it's going up and down and people will hope it's going up. And it appeals to other people who think it's so cool. But the people who think it's cool are very likely to lose whatever investment they're making in it because they're doing it because it's cool. That's not a good investment strategy generally.
Well, that's good advice right there. James, any thoughts on, you know, I'm sort of thinking that people might equate these cryptocurrencies with, you know, it never ceases to amaze me that there are Hello Kitty credit cards out there that, you know, everyone wants their own personal stamp on something. And I think that Stan just answered me that I'm comparing apples and oranges, you know, between a currency and a way of using an existing currency. But still, it seems to me that at least some of the appeal of these things is because of whatever floats the particular user's boat, if they're not in it strictly to engage in criminal activities.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, advertising works and Bitcoin's gotten a vast amount of free publicity. But I also think we have to credit, I mean, I'm not a computer scientist. From what I understand, though, Bitcoin is genuinely clever. It really is, the programming and the algorithms behind it are quite sophisticated, and it made a serious contribution to what we understand about algorithms. So that is part of the appeal, that it does represent a sort of technological advance for mankind, even if it doesn't catch on.
All right. Well, keeping on with our theme of technological advances and the good, the bad, and the ugly of them. Let's talk about things that are becoming more intelligent and specifically machines used in warfare. There's a good article, I think it's at The Verge, yes, by, I'll tell you who it's by in just a second. It's loading, Adrian Jeffries, about a DARPA-sponsored competition that happened in December in Miami, about intelligent robots, and it had teams of engineers from MIT and Google and Lockheed Martin and all kinds of people there, you know, showing off what their bots could do. But the article is about sort of a conscientious objector person who was there reminding us all that what we really don't want to have happen is weapons that can decide on their own when to push the kill button. And going through the article, it suggests that those sorts of things already exist. Quoting from it, the recently tested X-47B is one of the most advanced unmanned drones in the U.S. military. It takes off, flies, and lands on a carrier with minimal input from its remote pilot. But taking it into a more scary territory, the Harpy drone, built by Israel and sold to other nations, autonomously flies to a patrol area, circles until it detects an enemy radar signal, and then fires at the source. Meanwhile, defense systems like the U.S. Phalanx and the Israeli Iron Dome automatically shoot down incoming missiles, which leaves no time for human intervention. One of the people interviewed for this article had the great quote that you don't even have time to curse in order to deactivate something like this. So, what do we think about these war machines, James? Certainly, you were alluding to them in your discussion of the singularity, and how are we not going to manage to destroy ourselves?
Well, I think the war machines are actually probably good. I would rather have computers make decisions of who to kill if the computers are going to make more accurate decisions. I mean, I can see drones flying over areas where there are terrorists, and the drones have facial recognition software, and they're deciding who to kill or not, and they're more likely to get the terrorist, and they're less likely to accidentally kill the 10-year-old or to kill someone who just looks like the terrorist. So, you know, you can argue whether or not the U.S. should be in the business of trying to kill our enemies, but if we are going to be trying to kill our enemies, let's do it as efficiently as possible, and I think machines offer a path for that. And their machines are only going to get better at that.
Well, I'm sort of in agreement here. I presume that the IBM Watson machine could be programmed. If it can beat people in Jeopardy, it can probably beat those guys at their control boards who are controlling drones that are going to launch missiles when it's being done at a different facility, which my understanding was that's how most of the drones are run, the ones that are used in to seriously kill people. I don't doubt that they could probably have a program that takes in the information that's coming from the camera more rapidly and make a decision, because the decision's been made to sort of get someone. The final decision's already been made. It's merely a matter of deciding when is the proper time and how to aim the missile. And I don't doubt that a program could be written to do that better than people. And if it works better, and someone's made the decision that we want to take out this one terrorist, then it's really just an in-between. It's just a more efficient way of doing that. That's a little different than saying we're going to have a computer decide which terrorists to kill. Okay, that I'm not sure I believe that the program could be written to do that right now.
Oh, I strongly disagree with that. I think you'll have you probably already do have computers running sort of Bayesian analysis to say, okay, this is what we know about this person. What are the odds that this person will try to kill an American?
I don't doubt we have programs doing that, but they're still not being entrusted with making the final decision, and I'm not sure that we want to at this stage. Because even if you run Bayesian analysis or not, it may be very helpful, but it still doesn't give you the full cost-benefit analysis you'd want to do of what blowback there might be from destroying this person and whatnot, which is something that the computer is not going to be able to take into account because they're not broad enough yet.
Certainly right now, yeah, the computer could make the overall decision, but you might say to the computer, come up with 100 people most likely to harm Americans and we'll kill them, or we'll kill people where the odds of them the odds we think they'll end up being a terrorist are above 80%, so long as that number doesn't exceed 1,000 or something. If you put in those parameters,
we're in disagreement here, because you're admitting we're not really ready to let the machines make the final decision there.
Well, there's this interesting Department of Defense document, Directive 3000.09, that's mentioned in this article, released around a year ago, 15 pages long, and defining an autonomous weapon. And its definition is that it's a weapon that once activated can select, how does it do that, and engage targets without further intervention by a human operator.
Well, so that's the definition of what it would be. It doesn't mean, and this is, you're saying it was from 15 years ago.
They no, have, it's 15 pages long. It's from a year ago.
I would be curious to know whether or not anyone in the military has authorized the use of such a weapon. And my suspicion would be they haven't, because they don't trust those weapon jets. They don't trust the algorithms that would be used.
Right.
Well, I think we'll probably soon have them where you could imagine a robot and the robot's going with soldiers, and the robot's looking and it's able to detect signs of whether someone's going to shoot at the soldiers, and it will shoot first. So that actually could end up saving a lot of lives, not just of our soldiers, but our soldiers would be less likely to quickly open fire on someone who might be innocent if they know the computer is there. And the computer will be able to protect them if someone sort of jumps out in front and starts shooting at them.
Right, and it might assist with friendly fire type situations as well. Evan, what do you think about all this?
Thinking about these things, first of all, isn't it interesting how directives like this have really intimidating titles, like 3000.9 or whatever? It's not something fluffy like the Open Internet Order. But what I thought about is we automatically go to the bad application of this technology. It's like, oh my gosh, a machine is going to make the wrong judgment about who to kill. But there is the possibility for it to make the right judgment in a situation where a human would have made the wrong judgment. And I'm thinking of the situation, you see this a lot in police training, where police are run through simulations where they're apprehending a suspect, and the suspect, puts his hand back, or his hand reaches back into his back pocket as if to either reach for a weapon or to reach for a wallet. There's that split second decision where the officer has to decide whether to open fire because the officer's life is threatened. A machine may very well be able to run a Bayesian analysis or what have you, evaluate facts real coming to him in it. Isn't it weird? I referred to the computer as a him. Doing an analysis in real time that may inform the decision to not open fire on that target in a way where a human would have made an error. So that would help in friendly fire situations, but also in situations where it's not necessarily a friendly target. It could be an enemy, but one that is willing to hold up the white flag and surrender.
All right. Well, obviously, things that are armed with guided missiles are dangerous, and we want them controlled in a way that keeps the most people safe. Same thing goes with cars full of gasoline and able to propel themselves at high speeds into people and other cars. We've had the topic of car automation come up a lot on the show recently. We have a couple of stories on it. This week, another article over at The Verge about connected cars in general and the fact that Chevy now has cars that come with, I think, its own app store and also LTE connectivity in the car. And specifically on the question of liability, an accident in San Francisco on New Year's Eve where an Uber car driver, and Evan, I know you've talked about, no, what could go wrong with these unaccredited Uber car drivers, who is being sued for wrongful death. He's also being criminally charged with reckless operation of a vehicle because he hit a six-year-old girl and killed her in an intersection on New Year's Eve in San Francisco. The lawsuit, the wrongful death lawsuit against him is not just against him, but also against Uber, and claims that Uber has engineered its whole automation system badly and alleges that the Uber app and driver interface requires drivers to use the app in a way that violates California's laws against needing to be hands-free when you're driving. So how does car automation factor into our singularity and smart technology discussion today? Evan, we'll start with you.
Talking about the Uber lawsuit for the guy that hit the six-year-old girl, I mean, there's a lot of ways that that's just a relatively straightforward wrongful death involving an automobile case. I strongly doubt that when the family went to their aggressive plaintiff's lawyer working on a contingency fee basis, most likely his first thought was not to say, oh, it's Uber's fault for this newfangled technology that's doing there. He just sued Uber because Uber has probably the deeper pockets and under a theory of respondeat superior, where, you know, the employer is liable for the conduct of its employee if it was within the course of the employment and the employee wasn't on a frolic, the word that the law likes to use to exclude that respondeat superior liability there. So I think that's probably, you know, the fact that it's Uber was just sort of an afterthought and not the main part of the liability theory that the plaintiffs have here. As far as the other aspect of, you know, this question, will connected cars be safer? I mean, I was sort of felt like I was misled when I actually read that article because I thought it was going to be actually talking about the real innovations and safety that will happen with connected cars. You know, you'll be able to not be the subject of fatigue, or at least your ability to drive, move down the car won't be lessened because of fatigue and things like that. That the way that connected cars actually will make driving safer is, like, you know, you're messing around in with the, you know, with the apps that are on the dashboard. Those seem to be two very separate issues, and unfortunately sort of obscures the real question of safety when it comes to connected cars. I think there's some wonderful innovations there because humans are bad drivers, and I wonder if James and Stan will agree that there actually are algorithms and within our lifetime that will be developed that will make cars truly safer than self-driven cars truly safer than what a human could do. So,
yeah,
take what you will from that.
I think it's almost certainly we'll very soon have self-driving cars. I think that'll be one of the most successful commercial innovations ever, because when you factor in insurance, it actually might be cheaper to have a self-driving car. But when I started writing my book, I actually thought that the AI that might be used in self-driving cars would play a big role in the singularity. But unfortunately, I talked to someone at Google who works on AI, and he told me that no, AI doesn't really play a big role in self-driving cars. It's mostly an issue of mapping software. So AI doesn't really relate all, or at least the AI problems have already been solved for self-driving cars, and that really won't do much to advance that technology.
That's interesting.
I expect computers should do a better job driving than people in principle, because look, driving is not something that requires a lot of conscious effort. You're sort of on autopilot when you're driving most of the time, and computers should be able to do that much better. The problem that I foresee is one of the components that are being used to look ahead. I mean, just knowing what road you're on and how to get someplace, that's easy, and that could be done basically with practically just a GPS now. The bigger problem is checking for somebody being on the road that's not supposed to be there, or pedestrian, bad weather. I had a car that had, you know, the when you'd go into the auto drive at a particular speed, if the car in front of me slowed down, I would slow down. And if the car in front of me was going faster, I'd speed up. That was all very nice, but it didn't work in bad weather. Okay, it would shut itself off. It would start beeping. I presume they've gotten better. This was a few years back. My new car doesn't have that feature, so I don't know how much they've progressed. But the one place where you might need equipment that's fairly expensive, and this is where, you know, that comes in, that can get through the really bad weather. And you'd also, the other thing is to be able to tell the difference between a car that's in the road, or a ball that's going across the road, or a kid that's going across the road. That's the more complicated part here. I don't doubt it can be done, and it probably will be done in a few years. It'll probably be done cheap enough. When it shows up in cars, it'll have to be cheap enough. But there will be an expense in getting sensors that work well enough in enough conditions to see that. But I do expect that that'll be something, because that's a very simple, driving a car is a very simple thing most of the time.
Right. And I as I read through this article at The Verge and I listen to US Today, I'm sensing that we're all in for this time frame of an annoying thing happened to me on the way to the singularity, where as they try and make cars more and more responsive and intuitive, they're going to be asking you more and more questions, such as the one mentioned in this Verge article. It notices that you're out of gas and the car chimes in, you know, shall I navigate to the nearest gas station? And you're going to have to tell it yes or no. I already have a Ford with a lot of automation, and I find myself constantly having to tell the car no when it tries to intuit things. So, you know, we're far from a perfect system of having them be able to read our minds, aren't we, James?
Yeah, we certainly are. I mean, we're nowhere close to having, you know, full human-level artificial intelligence.
Yep. All right. What shall we move on to? Before we stop talking about robots and drones and things, I can't not talk about 3D printed drones, which I found in Evan's Twitter stream this week. And he says that they've been invented solely to make a trend watcher's head explode due to the convergence of controversy. I think this is so funny, Evan, and that they could only be better if we could buy them with Bitcoins.
Right. And if, you know, you were using it to track down Ed Snowden or something like that, we could work in a few things here. So
yeah, but they're thing, right? I mean, 3D printed drones are actually being manufactured, and there was one on Kickstarter that looks pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Looks like they are a thing. And, you know, I mean, it makes sense. You know, why not? And there actually was a military implication with this. We were talking about right. automated killers, but, you know, we could even bring in that issue pretty proximately with this as well. A general could be sitting in a command center somewhere and deploy an army of drones that at that moment doesn't even exist, but be printed up somewhere and then go and attack. So there are some interesting implications about this, but, you know, it is a convergence of two very controversial elements, but it seems like a natural convergence. And, there's really not much more to say about it. Not too many new issues really emerge out of it that are not already built into the controversies that are there with 3D printing and with drones to begin with. The 3D printing, you know, there's a lot of interesting intellectual property issues that we'll still have to sort out. And drones, of course, all those huge privacy implications among many others. I mean, those are just the two kind of biggest issues with all of this. But I had never, I guess, actually consciously thought about the two elements being combined. But once, you know, you look at read that article, it's like, oh yeah, well, only natural.
I mean, they have the potential, I think, to do a huge amount of harm. If you could imagine if an ordinary person could build a 3D drone and put a little bomb on it and send it off to kill someone and not get caught, that would probably destroy civilization. I mean, certainly any famous person could never, ever be out in public if, you know, anyone could kill them and get away with it.
Right. I mean, we see implications of that or indications of that now. Was it Angela Merkel who was in public somewhere and somebody flew a drone?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the threat is real. Now it would appear, but enough being scared of the future for one day.
Oh, I don't know. We'll see if we manage to be any more scared. Stan, any thoughts on 3D printed drones before we move on?
Well, I actually didn't read that article. I'm sort of skeptical that you'd have to have a pretty good printer or group of printers to be able to make the parts and then put them together into a functioning drone. I actually won't believe it until I see it. And where's the bomb making 3D printer? After all, if you can make the drone, what's the good if you can't make the bomb? That's the more interesting question, which I also don't think is likely to be something that's going to be all that easy to do.
Well, the guns are out there, right?
Guns are easy. Mm-hmm. Guns are really pretty easy. The bullets are already made. They're not making the bullets, I don't think. I don't think they're making the gunpowder. And so it's just a trigger that sort of hits and basically makes a spark. So that's not a problem. But there's a world of difference between a gun and a drone that can fly.
Yeah. There's already so many guns in the United States that really won't radically change things.
All right. Well, let's move on to a friendlier topic, the topic of the friendly judge. This is a story that involves the social web.
Oh, wow, a bumper. been a while.
Yes, I've got a few bumpers coming up here. Evan, this is one that you wrote up on internetcases.com. Fascinating story about a family law divorce dispute where the judge had made a friend request to the, and the female judge actually, had made a friend request to the female litigant while things were pending. The husband wound up with the more favorable property settlement. And on appeal, this friend request wound up being a pivotal factor in undoing that result, or at least revisiting it, right?
Right, right. Yeah, you've laid it out very well there. The precise issue before the appellate court was whether or not the trial court judge overseeing the divorce committed error in failing to recuse or disqualify herself in the proceedings after it was brought to her attention that everybody now knows that you, judge, tried to friend the wife in the divorce proceeding here. So, you know, the publications in the bar journals and everybody, all the commentators struggling with the appropriate use of social media by judges and lawyers and litigants, you know, just really eat this kind of stuff up, you know, these kinds of fact patterns. And especially when you have an appellate court telling a judge that she did something wrong, and, you know, that it seems like these sorts of situations get a lot of attention when, you know, here we have an example of where a judge messed up. So, you know, it's not too surprising of a result. It's a very much of a common sense result that, you know, a litigant, and this is the language that the court used, this cliche, was put in a between a rock and a hard place, whether to risk offending the judge by not accepting the friend request or engaging in a ex parte communication that would jeopardize the result of the case if it had turned out to be favorable to you. So perhaps even the more instructive part of the case actually came in some dicta where the court was talking about, now this is very much different than a situation where a judge is friending the lawyer representing the client. There's a distinction that the courts will make in the analysis between whether or not it's okay for a judge to friend one of the parties directly versus whether to friend one of the lawyers. And the court said, you know, think of the situation in small counties where the legal community is very tight knit. I'm thinking back, you know, my hometown, Bedford, Indiana. You know, I was at an event this summer where, you know, one of the well-known lawyers in town was sitting at the same table having lunch with the circuit court judge. So that's an everyday occurrence there. So it would be anomalous to prohibit Facebook friendships in, on that layer or level to take place. But a judge friending an actual litigant is not best practice.
I don't agree. I don't think it's that big a deal. I mean, Facebook really aggressively tries to get you to meet new friends. I don't know what happened in this case, but I could easily see the judge could friend a litigant without even knowing he was doing it. She was in his email list or she was connected to someone else. I mean, it's not that big a deal in Facebook when you friend somebody. I remember when Facebook first came out, a student set up a Facebook account for me to show me what it was about. And she went about friending some people. And I teach at an all-women's college. So, you know, she was friending like 19-year-old girls in my name. And I'm like, wait a minute, should you be doing this? Won't they think this is creepy? And she's like, oh, no, that's not a big deal at all. Don't worry about it. And it isn't, I don't think. And I think judges are now going to be afraid to be on Facebook because they might accidentally hit a button that friends somebody who's a litigant. And now that litigant has an option of, you know, getting an appeal if she loses the case. I think this might be a case of you lose the case, you go to your lawyer, gee, what can I do? Oh, the judge friended you. Oh, you're really upset by that, aren't you? Oh, yes, I was. Okay, well, how can I appeal it?
Well, I was thinking this would be a good opportunity to get into the topic that the chat room was asking about back in our discussion of the singularity, and that is, you know, how long until AI takes over the function of lawyers and judges and the judicial system. And this might be an instance where, you know, like with cars and war-related technology, maybe an artificial intelligence wouldn't have made this bad decision. But if it's something that is, you know, innate to the functioning of Facebook, maybe even the AI would be taken in by it.
Well, an AI wouldn't have been subject to the negative implications of influence, right? You know, mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that, sure, the judge as robot, as AI agent, may have friended the litigant, but so what if the friend declines or accepts? That's not going to affect the objectivity the way that, you know, the way that it would a human, you know, could be offended you know, they would go enjoy a sunset and then be offended because the litigant didn't accept the friend request.
Well, you know, that really depends on how the AI judge is programmed. If the AI judge is programmed to tit for tat, and if someone doesn't accept your friend, then you give it a worse ruling. Then it's just like a human being. So, it you know, you're assuming that the people that are programming this are programming it to be completely objective and to be a wonderful judge, which may or may not be the case.
Because it'd be the government programming it, of course. So it's going to be perfect.
I actually think overturning the previous verdict isn't enough. I think the judge should be censured for what they did. If this were, I don't know the sexual orientation of the judge, but if it was a male judge asking to be friended with a female litigant, particularly if she was young and attractive, the normal thing would be to wonder if, in fact, they're not trying to sort of cozy up to find out if there would be some way to have some sort of sexual relations later. And that would be something everyone would frown on. We don't know the motivation, but judges should be keeping their noses out of having personal interactions, which is what I view the friend thing to be, with the litigant. And they should, I think they should do more than overturn it. They should be telling judges to keep their noses out of Facebook, just as you shouldn't be having a drink with a litigant in a case that you're hearing or offering to have a drink.
James, back during our singularity discussion, someone in IRC raised that quote, the Robin Williams quote from Dead Poets Society, that goes, "And medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for." So does this mean that as we have this discussion, medicine, law, business, and engineering are going to be the purview someday of more intelligent machine intelligence than we frail humans are capable of carrying off?
Yeah, but actually so will beauty. I would predict within 5 years, most women in pornography won't be real women, but they'll be computer designed creatures that are more, that men perceive as more beautiful than any real woman ever has.
Oh, well, that's the case now, right?
So beauty is, I mean, computers are taking over beauty. I think computers will be able to make music and art that we perceive as more beautiful because they'll find the mathematical basis of what we consider to be beauty and create things that match it.
Well, but the real issue seems to be in what's in the eye of the beholder and, you know, the ability to perceive beauty. Sure, I mean, an automaton can create beauty. I mean, it can be programmed to create beauty, but can it appreciate beauty? And I think this is the second or third time we're kicking around this real
What do you mean by the word appreciate? I mean, state a test, and if the computer can pass the test, it can appreciate beauty. If it can't, then it can't. But the test is something where we could objectively determine whether it's passed.
I think what you want to say is humans are special, and
I'm going to protect the speciality by using the sort of vague criteria that can never be falsified.
Right. I feel like I'm talking to Dan Dennett because there's this notion that it's the phenomenological problem isn't really there. It's the essential problem of knowing what's going on in a person's mind. And I just am really skeptical, just intuitively, I don't know how to express this scientifically, that there's something different that goes on in the human mind, in the human intellect, when it perceives beauty that is would be very difficult, if at all possible, to create in a machine. And what we're kicking around here is we're just getting around the edges and we haven't touched on this. And if I bring this up, I'd be sad that we don't have 3 more hours to talk about it. We're talking about consciousness here, you know, and what it means to be conscious and to enjoy. And then that's where a bunch of discussion goes about rights and process.
The mind is the brain. The brain are cells. Cells are machines. If you can perceive beauty and understand it, then a machine can necessarily perceive beauty. Unless you're going to say that we were created by God and have souls and we can never replicate the souls, then, you know, the human brain is a machine. And so whatever the human brain can do, machines can do.
Well, I mean, Mr. Descartes, seriously, do you really mean that?
Yes,
I mean,
of course.
Is it that reductionist? I mean,
we're made of atoms. It just is. Yeah, I mean, I mean, I'm an atheist. I don't think there's anything, you know, supernatural about my brain. It's a machine. Okay. We're learning more and more about it. There's like 50,000 brain scientists in the world. They haven't become a part of the brain that like glows for no particular reason and is clearly supernatural.
Right.
We don't fully understand how the cells work, but they appear to be machines every bit as much as a car or a computer chip. The brain is consciousness is mysterious, but that's because we don't understand it. Consciousness being mysterious is a function of our ignorance, not a function of consciousness.
Actually, I think it's a little more than that. There's what's going on in the brain, but then there's all these chemicals and hormones and whatnot that are released and float around the body that are interacting with the body that has an effect. And so it's not just the brain and what's in the brain by itself. There's all these other interactions going on as well physically. Now, maybe you can get a computer that also emulates that component, but it's not just the pure thoughts going on in the brain, because we are more than just the brain. And so there's all these other chemical interactions independent of the thinking. And that's what I think is some of the difference. So let's say we're not talking about beauty that's pure aesthetic, but let's talk about sexuality. You see someone beautiful, you get all these physical reactions. How are you going to get the equivalent of that in the machine? It's not clear whether the machine can get turned on or not. Okay, now the machine can say, I am turned on, because you program it to say that, but is that really the same thing as when a human being gets turned on? And the answer is, well, it doesn't have all these chemicals going on, going through its body, having other physical impacts on what's going on that then feeds back to the brain. So I think by looking only at the organ of the brain by itself and comparing that to a computer, you're oversimplifying a lot of what's going on. Even if you don't, even if you're a complete atheist, and even if you don't think there's anything supernatural about it, it's still something that would be hard to do in a computer program by itself.
Yeah, and what I would add to that is just that notions of beauty are so subjective and ever-changing, too. If, in fact, we wind up living in a world where, as we see today, images of beauty are more manufactured than they are natural, maybe there will be a backlash and those images will no longer be considered beautiful. And so the program, if we're trying to get a machine to emulate human responses, the programming would have to constantly change and be subjective as well. And do you think you can duplicate that, James?
I don't agree with your assumption. I think what we find beautiful is determined by evolutionary selection pressures. I mean, men find women beautiful, though women would make good mates if they were cavemen, living in cavemen and cavewomen times. So I have a feeling standards of beauty haven't changed all that much.
All right. Well, I'm going to make turned on machines our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And I'm going to move on to another story that Evan wrote up at internetcases.com this week, this time on the copyright front. Okay, Evan, fascinating story here involving Quentin Tarantino, and most everything involving Quentin Tarantino is bound to be fascinating. Here, Mr. Tarantino had a script for a Western that he was sharing with a select group of people, and one of those people seems to have leaked it, and it got out on the internet, and Quentin got very upset about that in general and got upset in specific, in particular, at Gawker Media, because they published a link to where one could read the script. So this is attempting to be liability simply for linking to allegedly infringing material in an interesting kind of wrinkle. Can you shed some more light, Evan?
Sure. We don't talk about Gawker enough on the show. Remember last week we were talking about the Hulk Hogan sex tape and that issue. That was Gawker. So here we are talking about Gawker again. Gawker published an article that had a link, or actually over time they updated it to have multiple links to another online location where an anonymous party who had received a copy of the script uploaded it to the web. Gawker posted these links to say you can read it here. Click on the link and go here and download it. And so I think this happened, about exactly a week ago. And Gawker published the story last Friday, I believe. It was late last week. And then by Monday morning, Quentin Tarantino had prepared the complaint and filed it in federal court in California. So you know what his lawyers were doing all weekend. It's a pretty straightforward copyright complaint, but there's a lot of nuance if you actually think about it. There's claims of direct liability against the John Doe defendants, the people who actually upload it to this site other than Gawker, the site to which Gawker provided the link. But then there's also a claim of infringement against Gawker itself, or as you said, Denise, for publishing the link to the infringing material. And it's a theory of secondary liability against Gawker. The Tarantino is not alleging that Gawker is actually infringing the rights, but it's alleging that Gawker facilitated and caused this direct infringement by actually the direct infringement would be people downloading downloading the script once they click on the link. So it evokes some notions of the Grokster case that we've talked about already on the show once today, where there one induces another party to infringe if the object of the distribution of the device or the publication of the website, we could say, the object of that is to have direct infringement result here. So if this case doesn't settle, we could see another interesting decision coming from the courts about what Grokster-type liability means. We already have some guidance since Grokster itself. Grokster came down in 2005. In 2012, 2013, I mean, there were a couple of different opinions about the ISO Hunt case, the Columbia Pictures versus Fung case. So we have, the Ninth Circuit has said some things about what it means to be liable for copyright infringement just for posting a link to something, because posting the link itself does not implicate any of the exclusive rights of the copyright holder. But so you've got to look for some other way to find liability based on that conduct. So yeah, it involves Quentin Tarantino. So sure, it's going to be interesting. And Quentin Tarantino and Gawker are two very colorful entities. Something fun, yes, ought to happen with this.
Yeah, but the linking liability thing is certainly important and implicates just about everybody who writes on the web, and certainly people who are engaged in news or news-like gathering activities. Stan, would you be disturbed if Gawker were found liable in this case?
No, I don't think so. Gawker knew that this was a purloined object. If Gawker just said, we came across a website that has something on it that we think is interesting and we're going to link it, that's one thing. But as I understand it, Gawker was fully aware this was a stolen object. Now, it's the type of object, it's not clear to me that it diminishes that much in value just because it becomes available on the web. I mean, it's not something that you can necessarily get a lot of consumption value, and it's not clear that it's a competitor for the movie that would have been made based on it. I'm not sure the damages would necessarily be that great. But if in fact it was going to really damage this potential work, then Gawker has to make the decision, do we want to give access to this purloined item or not? And if we know it's stolen, why should we be helping out the thief and hurting the person who it was stolen from? So on a purely moral, forget what's legal or not, I have no problem with Gawker being found liable. They were trying to benefit themselves financially by putting up links. You get a bigger audience base, and the bigger audience base will increase the revenues that you generate. And you're doing it at the expense of someone who has had their object stolen from them and hasn't put it on there voluntarily. And I don't think you should be rewarded for engaging in an activity that sort of promotes in a way indirectly this behavior that we say we don't want to occur, which was the stealing of the item in the first place. Legally, from what I gather, I suspect there would be a case to be made. Part of, I think, really depends on Gawker's knowledge and actions and behavior. In the Grokster case, and in a lot of these cases where you had file sharing, it was very clear that the company's business model was, we've got stolen stuff here, we'll help you get it, and we're going to make money off of doing that. And their defense was, oh, there's a legitimate reason in doing that. There's people who put up music here that's non-commercial or that they've put up here and that they don't really care whether you they're perfectly willing to give it to you. They've given up their copyright or it's open source or something like that. And this good stuff will compensate for the bad stuff. But that was clearly not what their model was about. And in this case, Gawker was doing something that it seems to full well know what it was doing. I don't see any positive side that they could claim that they were providing a benefit to society in doing this.
James, do you have any different take on this?
A little bit. I do agree that what Gawker did was immoral. I worry about the chilling effect that it would be so easy to accidentally link to something that was copy protected. And I think if, you know, even if you can prove that Gawker knew what it was doing and it realized it was helping people violate copyright laws, there's going to be a lot of people who will be afraid that if they link to something without checking it out too carefully, someone in the future could come after them. And then you'll have people playing games. You'll have like political parties putting copyrighted material in places where they hope the other side links to it. So if you know your political enemies link to something and you can claim copy protection, you'll legally go after them, and this will just sort of scare people and it'll hurt communications on the internet. And I frankly would rather copyright law get a bit weaker and have a bit less protection than chill free speech rights.
Yeah, the only other thing that struck me about this, Evan, when I read through your coverage and also Eric Gardner's over on Hollywood Reporter Esquire, was the emphasis in the complaint on the word click here or we have it here, which the complaint seems to be attempting to imply means we have the document and we're giving it to you. You know, that we're not just pointing to some intermediary third party. And I just hope, you know, that the court doesn't get confused by that language.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's give the court the benefit of the doubt, because it could also just mean it's like, this is the inducement, you know, here it is, even if, you know, in the nomenclature of hyperlinks, that really means over there.
Right.
You know, I don't know if that's, you know, I'm optimistic the court will see past all of that. But as far as of what Stan and James have said, you know, I concur in as much as I think that Gawker shouldn't have done this and probably is liable under this theory of secondary liability. I would just say I would come to that conclusion without using terms like theft and immoral. Because I think it's just, we can talk about this in terms of copyright as being more in the form of trespass and, you know, and morals. Who cares about morals when we've got the law, you know?
Exactly. All right. One last story and then we'll be out of here. This one, as was the last one, is entertainment related, but this time we're going to play the bumper. All right, so this is actually just a quick kind of note that in the Dish Hopper feature suit, actually there are a couple of those suits going on. This is the Fox one, which has been successful thus far for Dish in defeating a preliminary injunction against the feature. So the lawsuit still goes on. They're going to get to the merits of the suit, but on the question of whether the feature can continue operating while the parties are arguing over it, the trial court said yes, the appellate court said yes, and then the appellate court just recently said yes again, that it's not going to review its own decision and it's going to let the feature remain and not enjoin it while the parties are litigating. Stan, you found this a fascinating point of discussion, so tell us why.
Well, it's really the underlying idea of what's going on that's fascinating, more so than the particulars of whether or not they're going to allow a preliminary injunction to go. And that is what you have here is a case of a market where people watch programs and the programs are supported by advertising. The viewers are happy. They're voluntarily watching. They're getting benefit out of it. The broadcasters are happy, or their transmitters are happy, because they're getting paid by the advertisers. They're getting paid more than the cost of the programming. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in business. So it's a win-win. Everyone's is happy. It's like most markets. The consumers benefit and the producers benefit. But this activity that's occurring makes the consumers happier because they would rather watch the programming without the advertising. But if all the consumers do that, they destroy the market and everyone is worse off. And so the question is, should the law be trying to keep this market that makes both parties better off from not engaging in an activity that will destroy the market and therefore make them both worse off, when one of the parties thinks that it's going to make them better off with what they're doing and wants to eliminate the ads? And that's the sort of interesting theory. Can you should you try to prevent behavior that's going to make the party worse off, where the party doesn't seem to fully understand that because they think they can free ride? So that's what's sort of at issue here. From an economic point of view, should you allow it? You can make a strong case that if, in fact, everyone were to use something like the Hopper, and if everyone could remove the commercials, they would all be better off if they could collectively agree not to do that. And they should all be in favor of a law that doesn't allow them to do that. Therefore, should that be the way the law rules? So from an economic point of view, it's efficient for them to actually come up against Hopper. Now, that doesn't mean the law will do it. And it's not clear, therefore, the preliminary injunction, which needs, I think, pretty strong evidence that they're going to win, should go through. But the actual economics of what's going on is you're better off here preventing people from doing what they think they want to do because they'll find out it makes them worse off.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I haven't read a whole lot of the briefing in the case yet, and we will have more substantive briefing as the case goes forward, whether that kind of public policy economic argument gets made in addition to the straight copyright infringement claims that seem to be also kind of problematic in this case, but being asserted. Anybody else have any thoughts on the Dish Hopper case before we go ahead and wrap, Evan?
No, nothing that I can add substantively to it. I mean, it's just interesting to see how this plays along in the saga with Aereo and I guess the IVTV part, you know, just emerging technologies and kind of the progeny of Cablevision. It's interesting to see how this area, the law will develop here.
Yeah. James?
I agree with Stan. I think, though, if people are allowed to strip out commercials, you'll end up having commercials embedded throughout the entire show. So they'll be impossible to get rid of, and that'll probably lower the quality of entertainment.
Yeah, and we see a bit of that already happening today as people already can skip commercials pretty efficiently. Let's give you quickly here, because we're going over our ordinary time, but we've had such a good discussion here today. It's been well worth doing so. So I'm going to kind of race through our tip and resources of the week. Our tip comes from Scott Michaud, listener of the show, constantly in IRC, who decided it would be fun to do an ask slash dot on the hypothetical question, what would you do, what would you suggest doing to protect your passwords from your own amnesia? So how would you sufficiently secure them and make sure that you're going to know them, you know, should you somehow forget or not have a great way of coming up with them again? And the reason I thought it was interesting and that Scott thought it was interesting is the whole notion that confidentiality that a lawyer can provide can be good security for this sort of thing. So a lot of the suggestions involved sort of parsing up your password strategy and having several lawyers have a piece of the puzzle and instructions to let you know, bring you up to speed in the event of some kind of catastrophe. So check it out in more detail. All the links to our resources and all the discussion points we've covered today are at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/144. And this ask/dot is a pretty interesting approach to your password strategy. Our resources revolve around our great guests today. We've already talked a lot about the first of them, Singularity Rising by James Miller. I just got word during the show that we're definitely putting the book in the running for the voting by my book club. So I'm hoping, I'm pulling for it, that we'll get to read that one and discuss it. Also, I wanted to highlight from Stan. Stan did a great definition, lengthy kind of more article than anything else on intellectual property and specifically focused on patent and copyright in something called the Library of Economics and Liberty. It's Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. So Stan did, it seems like you might have written this a few years ago, Stan, is that right?
Yeah, you can tell if you read it. It's definitely a few years old.
Just because, you know, the current events or the current issues, current controversies that you mentioned at the end are not all that current anymore. But it's a great discussion. And for anyone looking for overview of the, you know, the history of copyright law and the ramifications of it, and same thing with patent, it's a great resource. And also wanted to highlight the Center for Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation, which issues grants for research projects that may be of interest to people who listen to and watch this show. Can you just, in a nutshell, tell us what the center does, Stan?
It supports academic research, largely on intellectual property type of issues. I might mention as well that there's sort of an updated version of intellectual property. The Milken Institute asked me to write something up for them for the latest issue of their magazine called the Milken Review. And so I talk about copyright there. And and this issue is supposed to come out sometime in the middle of January, so maybe it's out already. That talks about current controversies and more current controversies if anyone was interested.
Wonderful. If you send me the link, I will put it in our discussion points for this show so that people listening down the road, as our intellects continue to evolve, will be able to find that particular bit of information. Also, the projects you guys are working on now at the Center for Analysis of Property Rights and Innovation include online, offline channel synergies, evidence from the video rental market. That sounds pretty interesting. And some other great topics over there too. So if you're someone interested in academic research, I encourage you to check this out. And I just can't thank you guys, Stan and James, enough for joining us today. Really wonderful discussion. Wonderful to have the opportunity to share your non-artificial intelligences with our audience. Stan, anything you want to leave our guests with? Anything you're involved in that's coming up that you want to highlight before we get on out of here?
Well, it's not really apropos to what you guys do, but I've basically spent the last year writing a book about research fraud in academia. I don't know when it's coming out. I don't know who the publisher will be yet, but I presume that if you had any interest in it or not, check my webpage every once in a while and you'll find out.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. And James, how about you?
If you are interested in working towards a good singularity, the best organization is the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, MIRI. They're trying to develop a mathematically provable, friendly AI that can bring us basically utopia.
Nothing wrong with utopia. Evan, it's utopia every Friday when I can get together with you and chat about such heady issues and angels dancing on heads of virtual pins.
Right. The same here. Yeah, really, really enjoyed it. And this has been, you know, a really great conversation. Sure, I've enjoyed it. You know, I wasn't joking when I wish we had 3 more hours to talk about consciousness and things like that. So
yes.
Really touched on some great issues and hope we can continue it someday.
Yeah, me too. All right, guys, we'll let you go and enjoy your weekends. I'll just mention that this show records live at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on Fridays. You don't have to join us live. It's fun to do so. We love it when you jump into IRC and play along with us and feed us information and suggestions and questions and corrections. If you can't do that, you can find the show at twit.tv/twill, at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're on Roku. We're in iTunes. However you like to consume your netcast entertainment and education, you're likely to find us there. Check out the twit.tv/twill page for all that information. And get in touch with us between the shows for sure. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. Let us know your ask/dot questions and guest suggestions and topic suggestions and critiques. We love to hear it all. You can do that over on Facebook and Google Plus as well. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.